Hello, my name is Michael Albert, and I'm the host of the podcast titled Revolution Z. This is actually the 20th episode of the podcast. It's the fifth of the strategy sequence. As the 20th episode, I suppose in a sense it's a little bit of an anniversary, a tiny anniversary. I hope you will consider helping us out so that we can have much longer, older anniversaries. You can do that at www.patreon.com/revolutionz. You can find out a little bit more about Revolution Z there, and you can also pledge to help us materially. We could certainly use it. Thank you. The title for this podcast episode is Some Basic Strategic Implications. It's about implications that the vision that we've been unfolding, participatory socialism or participatory economics, has for strategy. So let's begin. The reason for movements needing a shared vision is in large part so movement efforts can lead where one wishes to wind up rather than elsewhere or endlessly reproducing the present. But a second reason is that a positive orientation, rather than constant emphasis on the ills of the world, is essential to attracting and retaining commitment. All activism involves campaigns, projects, and struggles, including marches, boycotts, strikes, occupations, and much else, typically seeking to win various short-run gains. All activism that seeks fundamental change also involves, or should involve, overarching priorities or themes that we call strategy, seeking to combine short-term efforts into a trajectory of change leading toward long-term goals. Consider campaigns seeking higher wages in some workplace, or seeking better work conditions, or seeking more say over workplace decisions, or seeking restrictions on corporations dumping waste or contributing to climate catastrophe, or seeking increased taxes on the rich, or seeking free education and health care. All these efforts seek limited short-run gains called reforms. If battles for reform seek only short-run gains, we call them reformist. You win and you go home. But battles for reforms can also seek long-run gains. You win, or you even lose for the moment, but you keep on struggling in ways that try to arrive, eventually, at fundamental change. Aside from short-run demands, and the choice of how to apply pressure to win them, once one's goal includes seeking more, three new facets of the process arise. Determining what lasting views and desires activism should foster beyond its immediate aims. Determining what lasting organization activism should create beyond temporary arrangements to raise pressures able to win immediate gains. And determining who activism should mainly involve and in what manner. And these three facets are where activism gets strategic. So what might favoring participatory socialist economics, which is what Revolution Z's sequence of visionary episodes has so far made a case for, say about these strategic aspects of activism? Favoring participatory economics, to my mind, says that when fighting for some immediately attainable gain, we should address the involved issues in ways that establish understanding and that arouse desires related to how our long-run goal handles the same issues. For example, fighting for higher wages, we should develop desires for fully equitable wages, which, in the participatory case, means we should develop desires for income for duration, intensity, and onerousness of socially valued work. And we should reject income for property, bargaining power, or even talents, tools, or output more generally. Notice how this differs not only from what fighting for immediate gains without longer-term aims would propose, but also from what fighting for a more familiar but less comprehensive and radical socialism that indicates no specific new approach to income distribution would propose. With the participatory approach, fighting for higher wages for custodians in a university, say, or for technicians and cleaners in a hospital, as examples, we should ask why they get less than professors at the university or than doctors in the hospital, and not just why don't they get $15 an hour. The aim is for the struggle to not only seek valuable immediate gains, but to also arouse desires leading toward the ultimate goal. We win the $15, we celebrate, but then we move on to fight for more, leading toward equity. Current reality poses an immediate need of some constituency, like workers on a farm or residents in a polluted community, and it reveals possible paths to applying sufficient pressures to win gains addressing that need. Shared vision, presents the full values and assessments for related and more complete gains that we ultimately desire. Strategy links current reality and shared vision. While fighting for additional influence for workers in a plant, or for removal of some controls over them, for example, participatory socialism says we should also discuss self-management and the desirability of workers' councils. While fighting for better work conditions, or for better relations for workers vis-a-vis coordinators, for example, participatory socialism says we should also discuss balanced job complexes. While fighting for restraints on market madness and for laws punishing anti-ecological dumping, participatory socialism says we should also discuss participatory planning. And finally, while fighting for an array of gains, as, for example, for a Green New Deal, we should talk about the array of still more radical features that constitute participatory socialism. In every case, we unrelentingly fight to win the sought short-run reform, but we also seek to propel further struggle. And again, notice how each of these cases differs not only from what fighting for immediate gains without longer-term aims would propose, but also from what fighting for a more familiar but less comprehensive and radical socialism that indicates no specific new approach for council organization and decision-making, for division of labor and balanced job complexes, and for allocation and participatory planning would propose. Favoring participatory socialism also says that when creating organization, we should of course seek to make it efficient and effective enough to win gains now. But at the same time, participatory socialism says we should also seek to make new organization able to teach about, to inspire support for, and ultimately even to foreshadow and finally even melt into what we desire for the future. Favoring participatory socialism therefore means we should create organization with attention to empowering all participants and incorporating self-management. And if we have paid positions, incorporating equitable remuneration. And if we work with others, incorporating cooperative negotiation of intersecting efforts. None of this even arises if we are fighting only for immediate gains. Indeed, none of it arises if we are fighting for something we call socialism, which, however, includes no references to balanced job complexes, worker self-management, equitable remuneration, and participatory planning. This participatory organizational agenda follows essentially the same logic as, for example, embodying feminist or anti-racist relations in our organization, except in this case, it's about economics and class. We do it to ensure wider and more committed participation of affected constituencies, rather than their exclusion or subordination, whether it may be due to race, gender, or class. And we do it to plant the seeds of the future that we desire in the present that we create, to provide a showcase, to inspire emulation, and to provide a testing ground as well. As examples, consider a participatory socialist media project or electoral organization. In the media project, to be participatory socialist, there should of course be no owner or chief fundraiser calling the shots. Beyond that, however, there should also be no few empowered workers dominating the rest, but instead equitable remuneration and self-managed decision-making. And in the electoral organization, the same thing holds. In both cases, the idea is to provide a testing ground for these structures and to remove from the media or electoral work exploitative and authoritarian relations that sap creativity. Finally, it is also to avoid having internal class relations that interfere with dealing with class relations in society more broadly, which is a very serious problem for both left media, wherein the issue of coordinator worker relations gets virtually no editorial treatment, and for left electoral work, wherein many working class grievances and desires go effectively ignored. Finally, favoring participatory socialism says that activism and organization should involve workers in ways enlarging their confidence and their decision-making skills, and utilizing their leadership, again, analogously to similar priorities regarding blacks, Latinx, and women. But this in turn entails taking into account working people's circumstances and needs to ensure that movement organizations and events are accessible to them. Some ways would be, when possible, providing services like daycare, transport, and other mutual aid. It also entails orienting movement rhetoric, discussion, outreach, and of course demands to accord with the needs to involve working people, including their becoming ever more empowered. Even while it also means attracting and including people in the coordinator class, but only while challenging their sense of class entitlement. These various themes may seem modest when spelled out as succinctly as I just did. But if you think of movement organizations, campaigns, and projects, as well as of what movements say to their audiences, how they say it, and who they actually seek out to address, my guess is you will see that favoring participatory socialism in fact proposes rather dramatic strategic changes, as compared not only to seeking only immediate reforms, but also to seeking change limited to old-style socialist formulations that ultimately offer little new beyond dispossession of owners and enlarged government intervention in economics. The label socialism, as heard and used by people in the current surge of support for socialism, often refers to the whole society and not solely to a society's economy. The labels participatory economy and participatory society avoid confusion by differentiating the two meanings. Adding also participatory polity, participatory kinship, and participatory culture in that approach, as we will do in coming episodes with various guests, would sum to participatory society or participatory socialism. So in light of the recent socialist surge, from here on I will try to remember to take the label participatory socialism to refer to a whole new society, not just a new economy. And while I won't pretend to have myself given near as much time, thought, or practice to areas other than a better economy, I hope I have given enough to at least offer up some attention beyond economics in coming episodes in this series, and to have insightful guests add more to the mix. Doing so is important not only because we need vision for other areas than the economy, just as much as we do for the economy, since other areas are just as critical to the tasks of winning a new society and what it will look like, but also because in the past, economy has been deemed prior and more important, and I wouldn't want to inadvertently abet that flawed orientation. So by way of an economic vision summary to this point, participatory economics is a set of institutions for accomplishing production, consumption, and allocation while meeting people's needs and furthering their development. Participatory economics is a set of institutions designed to propel equity, solidarity, diversity, and self-management. Participatory economics is a set of institutions centered upon self-managing councils, remuneration according to effort and sacrifice, balanced job complexes, and participatory planning. Participatory economics is a set of institution, that is, that answers the question, if not capitalism, then what do you want? In turn, participatory economic program will be a set of demands meant to win improvements in people's lives in the short run, while simultaneously laying the basis for more gains and the eventual winning of a participatory economy in the long run. It might include near-term demands for just rewards, including, for example, profit, wealth, inheritance, luxury and income taxes, affirmative action to redress inequities, full employment, minimum wage supports, social wage supports, reverse income taxes, higher wages in general, and also just rewards inside our movements. It might include near-term demands as well for self-management, including, for example, establishing workers and consumers councils, democratizing information access, democratizing workplace decision-making, establishing consumer influence on production, democratizing budgets, and also self-management inside our own movements. It might include near-term demands for dignified work, including, for example, upgrading degrading jobs, regulating overly empowering jobs, creating balanced jobs, empowering all workers, and also dignifying and balancing work in our own movements. And it might include near-term demands for rational, humane allocation, including, for example, developing council infrastructure and democratic knowledge disbursement, socially regulating prices, expanding qualitative descriptive information, promoting solidarity, placing human needs above profitability, democratizing budgets, winning more leisure and less labor, respectful, sustainable ecological relations, and participatory allocation inside our movements. Okay, suppose we adopt a participatory program encompassing all the above. What might we then highlight as our central demand? The whole list is a bit long. What package of connected features might we choose as a linchpin of our economic efforts, an element that produces public visibility and widespread support? What is our version of abolish slavery, get the vote, end the war, free my people, for the economy, in the short to medium run, and alongside parallel prioritized program bearing on cultural, kinship, political, international, and ecological focuses? What current aggregated demands within the broad program might best simultaneously A. introduce economic needs people currently feel, B. propel participatory economic consciousness raising, C. empower people to seek still more economic gains, And D, galvanize people to win sought economic gains and simultaneously advance the encompassing broader economic program they are part of. I'm going to hazard a guess about which combination of demands might be collectively pursued to best encapsulate these goals, albeit very loosely and broadly, not least realizing that even near-term history can hold many surprises. Perhaps we could demand 1/4 less work time for everyone, plus a parallel 1/4 drop in wage and bonus income for the top quarter income earners in society, including an additional 1/4 profit tax on their income from capital, an additional 1/4 wealth tax for all wealth above, say, $3 million, an additional 1/4 income tax due to their still way too high hourly income, plus no change in total wage income for the next to the top 1/4 of society, and a 1/4 raise in total wage income for the bottom half of society. Perhaps as an added element, we could demand that overtime must be paid at twice the rate as normal time, and that firms cannot hire or maintain overtime workers while there are applicants for normal time labor. And perhaps we could add that anyone who wishes to work beyond 3/4 of their current load can do so, but only in special employment programs initiated and paid by the government, administered locally by workers and consumers, and directed at improving local health care, education, social services, public housing, and other basic functions in poor communities, where pay for this surplus work would be at twice the minimum wage, and the minimum wage, by the above requirements, would be 2/3 above what it was before the demand is won, until other pressures raise it still further. Then alongside all of that, perhaps we could demand that with gained revenues, the government invest in social programs, including training the unemployed to fill newly open work positions, training folks in previously unemployed or unskilled jobs to take up higher skilled work left unattended by the reduction in workload of the currently well-employed, oversight of operations in each workplace by unions and workers' councils, research and activism to pare away socially useless labor in advertising and similar worthless pursuits, and service work for those wanting to add their energies to advancing health care, education, social services, public housing, etc. The work reduction and income-altering scenario aspect of the program would release, I think, more income than it hands out, assuming any resultant lost output is confined to useless and pointless products, another aspect of the program. But would the freed income, equal to 1/4 of the current wages, bonuses, and profits of the top 1/4 income earners in society, fall short of the costs of the job program, plus the cost of training and increased income for the bottom 1/4 of all earners? Perhaps it would. But if so, we could then demand that the government reduce defense spending and spending on the prison industrial complex, and thereby free appropriate people to work in the real economy, making up for lost hours and funds needed to handle program expenses. And then, of course, we might call the whole package, suitably refined after research and experience, a Green New Deal, therefore also demanding, of course, ecological cleanup and massive investment in renewables at a scale sufficient to save and nourish the planet. What would all this do? Well, by reducing everyone's work time commitments by 25%, it would not only reduce stress and enhance daily life, but also, for those desiring it, greatly empowering the public to have time to develop agendas of change and to fight for them. People could do this with their newfound time either through the social programs by which they can also get additional income or via volunteer movement activism. The program would also dramatically redistribute income. Even before derivative impact on bargaining power changes wages further, which it certainly would, the top 1/4 would lose 1/4 of their profit income, a large cut into their wealth yearly, 1/4 of their previous wages and bonuses due to reduced labor time, and due to an additional income tax hit. Yet even this group could be addressed about the benefits of the program, not only in moral terms regarding the well-being of others, but also because through the changes they will get more free time and will also enjoy many collective benefits such as reduced hostility in society, increased public goods, and so on. The next half of the population would have a 1/3 hourly pay rate increase so that they would earn the same amount as before, but for 3/4 the time spent at work. They would therefore benefit from reduced work time and increased hourly pay rate, from the results of social spending, and also from the changed balance of power between society's classes due to newfound security, etc. The bottom quarter of the population would also spend three-quarters of the time spent before at work, although the unemployed, of course, increased their time at work. But now they would get a quarter more total pay than before, which would be a two-thirds hourly pay increase. They would also benefit most from the new social spending and from changes in balance of power among society's classes. Obviously, the program would immediately greatly improve the condition of society's worst off. But more, it would diminish and perhaps even eliminate unemployment, while also reducing workday length, thereby securing the weak against job threats by the strong and further empowering workers to take a still larger share of output as they solidify their new strength. The redirection of much labor to social programs would also not only benefit the poorest constituencies in society directly, due to new schools, housing, etc., it would also greatly empower them, leading in turn to new demands for better wages and conditions and other social improvements. Likewise, efforts to replace highly skilled labor reduced by a quarter for such jobs would uplift other workers, eliminating barriers to entry to better tasks at work. Finally, massive green outlays would obviously benefit everyone, all life even, in averting ecological catastrophe, though relative to what would have otherwise transpired, most gain again would go to the previously worst-off sectors. The clever strategic aspect of the program is, I think, that at its heart is a core demand to work fewer hours, something that people at every level of our society think is warranted and desirable, and which no one would be able to powerfully argue against. The rest of the program flows logically from the desire to reduce hours and save the ecologies in ways most beneficial to the worst off while improving the overall quality of society. In addition, the program would open doors to broader issues of remuneration, power, job definition and allocation, budgeting, and broad valuations of direction of investment. The program, in other words, would win terrain that would leave folks not only immediately better off, but also more empowered and ready to struggle on. When thinking about what might be a linchpin economic campaign that could galvanize broad and deep support, in this example, and it really is just an example, and it really did go on at length, I know, I gravitated to demands about length of work time and associated income because my experience suggests that time pressures are greatly felt, greatly despised, and a great barrier to radicalization, and therefore a great target for a massive campaign. The whole project just embellishes demanding 30 hours work for 40 hours pay. And I have to admit, even that simple demand, all by itself, even without diverse caveats and improvements, would be a fine focus for a purely economic program. Embellished more or less as above, however, seeking a quarter less work time plus income corrections looks to me like a wonderful lightning rod, linchpin, and foundation for economic struggle. Especially when conceived and sought in light of preparing for further gains and folded into and in turn augmenting the necessary ecological endeavors of our time. The point is, different aims yield different strategies. Participatory economic aims not only differ from reformist approaches that don't challenge defining economic relations, but also differ from many other socialist approaches that explicitly challenge property relations, but largely ignore or even support remuneration for output or for power, corporate divisions of labor, and market or centrally planned allocation, each of which become central targets for the participatory approach. Okay, I wish I didn't, but to close, I need to ask you once again for your help. Please take a moment to visit our Patreon page, P-A-T-R-E-O-N, www.patreon.com/RevolutionZ. There you can find out a bit more about Revolution Z, and should you so choose, you can pledge us some material help. We really do need it, just as we also need folks to use social media or your comments or interactions with friends, workmates, or family to promote Revolution Z to reach new audiences. I thank you in advance for listening and for any support you may be willing to lend. I know that for many, the biggest impediment to helping is actually the time it takes and the mindset entails. It can feel futile, insufficient, etc. So why bother? All I can say is that telling others about Revolution Z can take as little as a few minutes on social media or sending an email or having a conversation. And helping materially can take as little as 5 minutes visiting www.patreon.com/revolutionz and donating as little as $3 a month, or whatever more than that you might choose. About 100 of you have very generously done so already, so I don't have to pull the plug, cover the mic, for want of support. But to expand will require more aid. It seems about 1,000 people are already listening regularly to Revolution Z. If you are one, how about this? flip a coin. If it comes up heads, visit www.patreon.com/revolutionz and become a patron at whatever level suits you. If everyone listening does that, Revolution Z will be funded through the next year and beyond, not just to persist, but to greatly enlarge its offerings. The point is, far from futile or insufficient, the impact of even very modest promotion or donations on Revolution Z's future can be profound. 100 generous listeners have made it possible. Now you can make it more worthy. So will you help support a podcast, one out of about 750,000 that exist? Because this one isn't about how bad things are, but is instead about how good things can be. And because this one isn't about how daunting capitalist, corporate, racist, neoliberal, misogynist, and even fascist obstacles are, but how powerful and effective informed, committed movements can be. Give Helping Revolution Z a thought, please. Flip a coin and act for us. Or forget the coin, just say yes for Revolution Z. And, that said, this is Michael Albert signing off until next time for Revolution Z.